Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello and welcome to Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's podcast guest is Tipa Snow, occupational therapist, educator, and one of the most influential voices in dementia care. Tipa is the founder of Positive Approach to Care and is known around the world for helping families, care partners, and senior living professionals better understand brain change and connect more meaningfully with those living with dementia. Her work challenges fear-based narratives and replaces them with practical strategies that truly work. Tipa, welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. Well, it's a real honor to have you here. Now, dementia care is often framed around loss, what someone can no longer do or remember. But there's a growing movement that shifts that narrative in a positive direction. What does it mean to take a positive approach to dementia care?
Well, in my experience, I can't use what you can't do. It's not possible. What I can do is engage with you and see what you have. And that's where we can come into relationship and I can work with you. So if you didn't understand English, me using English words to communicate wouldn't serve any purpose. If, however, I went thirsty, that one word and those actions could get my message across. And so I think by recognizing, you have some losses, changes. I call them changes because when you lost something, your brain doesn't give up. Your brain picks something else to use. And so you're more tuned in to what I'm doing and how I sound when I'm doing it. You're more paying attention to things that I might not be paying attention to, but you also might miss things. And so I need to tune in to the reality of who you are now, not just who you were, and what you're capable of. Because that's what we have to work with and come together with.
That's great. Now, why do you think fear is still a dominant emotion that people associate with dementia?
It really is interesting. I'm really curious about it myself because for me, it's like, isn't that interesting? Isn't that curious? Isn't that different? Wow, that's a surprise. But I think human beings, as a rule, like the predictable. They like once they master and get something and they know something, they know someone, they can then not have to think about it so much. Then they can go on automatic pilot. Like when you've been married for a while and you know your spouse likes coffee, you just hand them the cup. You don't say, would you rather have tea or coffee this morning? Because you know. And I think what dementia does is rob us of our knowingness. And it forces us back into a space of paying attention, being observant, because the reality is dementia is ever-changing. It doesn't like to be stable. And so what you could do 5 minutes ago, you may not be able to do in the next five. So I don't get to relax into my routine, into my habit. If I'm going to work with you, I've got to be attentive and alert. I'm on the job. And maybe people don't want to be on the job so much.
Sure, sure. Now that makes sense. Now, dementia is surrounded by a lot of assumptions. Many of them are outdated or simply, untrue. What misconceptions about dementia do the most harm to those living with it?
The idea that everybody experiences the same kind of losses and changes in the same order, in the same sequence. So because it's so prevalent and because there's such a loud voice about it, Alzheimer's takes the front seat often. And one of the services it doesn't provide is if I'm living with Lewy body or I'm living with FTD, frontal temporal dementia, or I'm living with a vascular dementia, my symptom profile may be pretty different than I would see with Alzheimer's. And so, why is she doing that? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, who is she talking about? There aren't any people in this room. And it's like, but with Lewy body, I have visual disturbances, hallucinations pretty commonly. And so being able to respond to that effectively as a person in support has to be modified. And if you don't know what I've got and you see this symptom, you you may be thinking, oh, I bet she has a urinary tract infection. Oh, I bet she should go. She needs a psychiatric eval. And it's like, well, it pays to sort of get a pattern established of what am I living with and how's it going. And I also think the other big mistake people make is that they think it can only happen to old people. And it's all about the memory. And it's like, memory's this much. And then we have all this other stuff that's going on, frankly.
Sure. You know, that's interesting that you refer to that as, or at least acknowledge that the assumption is it only happens to older people. Yeah. And we didn't discuss this ahead of time, but did you see the movie Still Alice?
Uh-huh.
A few years back? That was, I thought, a fascinating portrayal. And I can't speak to how true it was. I think it was based on a true story. But what are your thoughts?
She did a really pretty decent job of the whole thing. Yeah. No, she's very skillful.
And I thought it was a great way to kind of bring the story forward and have the viewers really kind of experience what she was going through and what it might be like.
Yeah. So. We have a lot of friends that we call them our core team, people who live with dementia, and they serve us by providing us with feedback and details and insights and conversations. So we have a friend, Joanna, who has young onset, and she was a forensic psychologist. And so she would do these evals. And she was saying, I think there's something going on with me. And everybody's going, you know, you just work in the field too much. And hers hit her in her mid-40s, university professor.
Wow.
And it's like, wow.
Yeah. We never know. We never know. So how early should individuals and families start learning about brain changes?
Well, I would like us to learn more about brain health and wellness when we're younger, because I don't think we put the energy into it. Kids know their body parts, but they don't know the brain parts. And yet your brain parts really are super important to your development as a human being. Learning that you have an occipital lobe and you should protect it because it processes everything you see. Knowing that you have temporal lobes that take in all the auditory data and figuring out, wow, you've got language in a specific area over on that left. Boy, it would be super important to protect that. Now, you know, up here, this is where you think things through and you're not real good at it when you're young. You have to be like mid-20s, late-20s, early-30s to actually fully develop that. So you probably want to protect that too. So there's reasons why you should wear helmets. Sure. It's not because I told you so.
Right, right. And that's a really good point, because so often it feels like a parent trying to put boundaries or whatnot rather than demonstrating the value of that. I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, the discussion about keeping your volume down on the headphones, you know, and I did it to some degree, but probably not as much as I should have. But, you know, there are those things that have lifelong consequences, you know, if only the younger.
So the brain fitness, brain wellness then figures into, if I know how my brain's supposed to work, then I could start to notice when it's doing something funky or unusual or, that's weird. I might even notice that maybe what I'm feeling is a lot of really sad, debilitating thinking, and I could call it for what it is. Wow, there's changes in my brain chemistry. I need some help because this isn't typical. Or, boy, I'm really revved up. I can't seem to settle down. I could use some help. So our own wellness, we wait until there's so much evidence that something isn't going well. And then we talk about screening. And I think we're past screening. We're talking now about having to deal with changes that are fairly significant and are going to alter both your life and my life.
Sure.
If we're in a relationship.
That is interesting. And we were talking a little before we hit the record button about how I think historically people view someone who is going to be living with dementia or dementia who has experienced, some of the early onset that they should be, viewed with pity. But in reality, there are different ways to live and still live a full life. But I think for the for the person they're living with, that can be a real challenge, and they're exhibiting loss or feeling loss right through the process.
Yeah, I think for sure the relationship is going to change dramatically. And depending on what our relationship was before, we'll feel it fray and break and reconfigure. And it's hard. I mean, living with brain changes are hard, whether you're on the inside of the brain change or on the outside observing and interacting. But it's very different than being a victim. and that idea of being a victim and suffering. It's like, you got to tell me in this moment if you're feeling like some sense of, this is really hard, I hate it, I'm suffering, or I'm not. I don't get to impose that on you. That's not my job. My job is to figure out how to support you through what you're going through.
Hopefully. I love that perspective. So as dementia progresses, it's not just about memory that changes, or it's not just memory that changes. It's the way that the brain processes language and meaning changes as well. That can make everyday conversations far more challenging than we realize. What does traditional communication often fail, or why does traditional communication often fail as dementia progresses?
So if you just shared with me, like a very few moments ago, like that we were going to go to the doctor's at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And so I go and say, oh, okay, well, I need to write down a few things I want to ask him. And I come back with a piece of paper and I say, now, what is it we're doing this afternoon? Your first reaction is like, well, we're going to the doctor. What are you asking me for? We already talked about this. And that reaction of, or if I've done it a couple times and you say, what did I tell you the last time? Well, suddenly your behavior really changes for me. And what you haven't recognized and acknowledged is, wow, she's not able to hold on to new data. I just gave her the data. What she was able to hold on is something's happening this afternoon. What she can't hold on to is the detail of what it is. So communication isn't going to work like it used to because I can't hold on to that detail and use it to do something. So if I say to you, like you say, we're going to go to the doctor, and I say, okay, well, I need to write down a few things. You know what, Tipa, that's a great idea. Tell you what, so we're going to the doctor. What are the kind of things you're interested in finding out going to the doctor? So all of a sudden, rather than me going off by myself, trying to hold on to going to the doctor, write these three things, and I get lost, you're starting to recognize I need support to go from doctor visit to writing things down because I'm a detail person. I like to be in control and in charge. Whereas I go, oh, okay, what are we having for lunch? I'm not a detail person. It doesn't matter to me. So now we talk about who's the individual that we're working with and who were they and how are they changing or staying the same?
Sure. Interesting. So what are the most common communication mistakes that care partners make?
Not using reflection. So when you asked me that question, I immediately answered you. So ask again, if you would, and let me try the reflection.
Sure. So what are the most common communication mistakes that care partners make?
Ah, so you're wanting to know what are some of the most common mistakes. Well, one of the mistakes that sometimes gets made is we jump ahead in a conversation thinking you're with me, but I didn't check in. So would you rather have something hot or cold to drink at lunch today?
Interesting.
Because what I've given you now, what do you want to drink at lunch? Whoa. I just asked you to go into your memory banks, look at the thing called drinks, look through the laundry list of all the drinks that are possible, sort that out, and now imagine it is lunchtime and what would you like?
That's fascinating.
Versus hot or cold. Pretty concrete. Sure. You'll tend to pick one. I'll go from hot. You thinking coffee or something else? Now it's either or. Move it forward. So I'm learning more of a stepwise progression in keeping you with me and in keeping you engaged in the conversation versus getting you, what do I want to drink, Lord? I'm not thirsty right now. Safety valves. I'll tell you later. Let me think about it.
Sure.
Disengage.
Interesting. And you know, I would imagine for the care partners, they have to make sure that they are keeping their own patients in check. Oh. But if they're, you know, have these skills, they can and understand the process. Yeah. They can really modify how they ask the questions, how they communicate to have a meaningful conversation.
Yeah. And that also allows me to discover if I have been your spouse or your daughter or whatever, it allows me to discover, am I good at this or am I really frustrated by this? If I'm super frustrated by this, what other jobs are there in this story because this may be not be my best storytelling technique. I mean, I might need some other job to help support someone who is in this position. Because I think what I have discovered over the years is not everybody's meant to be a direct care partner for somebody living with dementia. And yet I can love you a lot. It just doesn't match up for us to work together a lot 24/7 because we just wear each other out.
We're having a hard time together. That makes perfect sense. So you've talked in the past about how communication goes far beyond words and how tone, body language, and even where we position ourselves can either build trust or create stress for someone living with dementia. How can tone, body language, and positioning change an interaction?
Yeah, so if you could imagine your visual field getting harder for you to take in all the data around you, like if you look around you and notice everything around you, and by mid-state dementia, you're sort of limited to what you would see through binoculars, like about 18 inches, like the screen width, pretty much. And I were to stand right here and I say, now, have you taken your vitamins yet? Can you see the vitamins?
Nope.
If I were to say, I'm wondering, I don't think these got taken yet. Here, tell you what, two of these. Here you go.
Interesting.
Very different than if I say, here, I need you to take your vitamins. Here.
Sure.
What do you think about my hand coming at your face right now?
Yeah. A little like a 3D movie. But
it is. Well, and that's the thing that we have to realize is if you have binocular sort of vision, how much you can take in, what's right in front of you is really important. But I can do a better job of supporting you if I show you right in front of you what I'm talking about.
Sure.
And put
holding
myself
the glass
to
of
the
water.
Side.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing you say is literally it's that kind of binocular vision. It's not metaphorical.
Right. I mean, it's like a very common phenomena. As my brain is more challenged by the world, my brain says, pay attention to the center field. That's where the good stuff is. I can't take in all this sundry data. And it also means if I try to find something by looking, I could look right past it and miss it. Because I'm looking so fast, I can't see, literally. Where did you put my glasses? Well, Tipa, they're right there. Well, I didn't see them. You just had them in your hand, didn't you? It's like, now we're starting an argument. And it's like, I didn't pick them up. Why? Now, what happened to my voice?
Sure. Yep. And you're right. It does start to become, kind of picking at each other and can, create stress quite quickly. Now, how can better communication, and I can imagine how, but reduce stress and behavioral challenges?
Yeah. The first is to recognize, I need some help. Things are changing enough that our old habits aren't serving us well. I could use some guidance in what kind of support works best in this situation. And classically, what I would say is give a visual cue, add a verbal cue that matches. And then if you're going to offer something or do something only after you've done those first two and it seems like you're connected, do you want to use touch or give them a physical object? Because if you hand me something and I say, well, what is this? And it's a pill and I start chewing it, you're going to like, oh, what do you do? No. And then again, we're on a different wavelength. Or if I reach out and start to pick something up and you're like, oh, that's hot. What would be a natural instinct on your part? If I start to reach for the stove and there's a hot pot on there, what would you do without thinking, do you think?
Sure. I mean, I guess, even if I were the care partner, or if I were the person, care partner, I would yell, stop.
Yeah, you'd yell. You probably would not think, ooh, I could really use your help. Hang on a second. Come here. Because what I've done is substitute. I've gone, ooh, which means immediately something. Yep. Let me pay attention to you. And I got you deflected and attracted you to something else. So you're not doing the dangerous thing anymore. And I never said that's dangerous. You need to be careful because I know if you knew that, you wouldn't be doing what you were doing.
Sure. But no, that does make good sense. So this is a question that every Roundtable Talk guest gets.
What's really funny is people will say, that makes such good sense. And it's like, yeah, but it's not common practice.
No, you're right. It isn't because I guess it's not the way we would normally communicate. But I mean, it certainly, as you're saying it kind of illuminates the whole not misdirect, but just thinking about it differently.
It's really getting the person to notice what you want them to notice and not pay attention to the thing you're trying to avoid. And it's just, it's a skill-based thing, but it's not like rocket science. It's just common, quote unquote, common sense.
Sure. And, you know, it's also, I guess, as I'm kind of listening to you and thinking about it, you know, on the one hand, it might sound manipulative, but really on the other hand, it's really about communicating in the way that is going to be received.
If I want you to get my message and you get, and I get your message, then I have to change what we're doing because something's changing and I can't fix it.
Sure. You know, and it's the other point, I'm an adjunct at Penn State and teach intro to advertising. And in the book, one of the fundamental principles is the human communication process. And it talks about how the sender encodes a message, sends it through a channel, and then the receiver decodes. And, you know, as I'm listening to you talk, I'm really thinking about how different that receiver decoding is in that process, that, you know, that people just, I think, figure that they understand how to do it, but really it's turning that decoding and the receiver on its ear a little bit.
Nice job. Yeah, that's exactly. It's recognizing, if it's not working, something's got to change, and they're already changing. So I mean, the thing that can change most readily with skill is actually me.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So, and again, this is a question that every roundtable talk guest gets. What are you looking forward to as you age, Tipa?
Moments of pleasure, times of purpose and value, still doing things I love to do with people I like to be with, having time alone that allows me to reflect and gather myself and participate in the world in a very small, big universe way, and not knowing everything.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
I always went through to be something that I don't know that I can find out, that I could explore, that I can be curious about. If I ever think I've got it all, then where's the fun for me?
And I think that's well said, because so often, I mean, I would like to think that we all remain curious to a degree. But yeah, once you figure, okay, I got that, then you kind of stop even having the possibility of learning or experiencing
something. When I stop being curious, I miss so much.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Now, through our conversation, we've used the term care partner. You prefer that as opposed to caregiver. Why?
Yeah. I believe there is no care about me without me. And I think it's time to quit treating someone living with dementia like they're football and we're the team and we're going to pass the football around. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. They're the quarterback. And I can coach. I can be on the team. But it's their life, it's their care. So I've got to figure out how to work with that human being. It never stops being their care, their life, their surround. So what I've got to figure out is how do I weave myself and the support that we can offer into that life so that it's not so horrendous to accept it that you'd rather not be in the life than tolerate it. And it's like, well, that means I have to partner with you. I can't just give you care, because if I give the care, you have to receive it. And if you don't want it, you don't want it. So I've got to figure out how to get it to where you'll go, oh, you've got something. Like, just, it's right here on the edge. Here, try getting it off. See whether it's crusty or not. I don't know. And to see whether you'll work with me that way versus me just coming in with a washcloth and going, oh, you've got oatmeal on the corner of your mouth. Let me get that. Which for an mature adult has a whole lot of connotations. I can't.
Sure. And you know, I love a lot of the language that you've used, but you know, it does feel very maternalistic, but you know, even thinking about a team and viewing the person living with dementia or you know, some sort of a different way of you know, memory loss. How do you term that? Is it memory loss?
The person living with the brain change.
Sure.
Yeah.
Good. So if someone's living with that, you know, not just viewing them as something to be dealt with, but yet, and I love how you use the word life a lot in there too, because that is so important.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is they're not less, they're different. Sure. Their brain works so differently. and it's going to continue to work differently until it quits working. Yes, if I look at the volume is going down, but they're still living life. And until it stops, it's theirs to live. I mean, I've got to figure, if I can figure out how to support that life, boy, does it change everything for both of us.
Sure. And I'd mentioned again, you know, in our previous conversation that one of the things that I have learned about working with older adults with brain change, I love that term, is that they can still live a fulfilled life. And again, I don't mean to be flip at all, but they won't necessarily remember it. But in the moment, they can live a fulfilled life.
Yeah. I mean, the number of friends I have that now live with new purpose, and I have several who have actively said, I wouldn't go back if I could now. And at one point I thought all I wanted to do is go back. And now I realize, no, I don't. There's something about being here that's important, and I'm going to stay until I can't anymore.
Sure, sure. Now, being a care partner to somebody with dementia can be emotionally and physically draining. What are the early signs of care partner burnout that can often get ignored?
If I were to ask you, tell me three things you've done today for yourself.
That would be hard.
Tell me something you're doing with your person that you feel really good about. Tell me something about your person that you find pleasure when you're with them. If you can't give me some of those things, it's time to have a conversation about how you're feeling about the work you're doing, how you're feeling about the relationship you have, and how whether or not you're finding time to take care of yourself. Because historically, this work that people take on and do, 80% or more is done by unpaid people, like family members, friends, community. And we don't train people. We don't prepare people. We dump people into this and they keep going until they drop. And it is my mission to change the dynamic that for one person living with brain change, there's one person who's supposed to do all the heavy lifting and say, no, we need at least three people and maybe five and maybe more. I mean, we need to build community around this condition. And it's not all medical. I mean, it's filling a day. It's filling life. It's finding pleasure, purpose. I mean, we should be spreading this a little wider because many of us are going to experience it. So let's quit hiding away in these spaces and let's start saying, well, yeah, there's brain change.
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting. I cut you off. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, that's it. Just okay. There's brain change. So how do we live on? Because, you know, until we find a cure, how do we live on with one another, around one another, with one another?
Sure. No, that's wise words. Those are wise words. But you know, when you'd mentioned that, I think you'd mentioned something like, you know, roughly 80% of people are unpaid care partners. And, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, I'm sure a large portion of that is perhaps out of guilt or feeling like they need to, or a large portion is also out of limited resources and not able to find a more professional, I wouldn't say more professional, but, you know, paid partners.
Paid support. Yeah. Paid just support. So you can step away and do other things that you need to get done. If there isn't a community to support you, I think we've got this model in our minds that like parenting and child rearing and then aged care and particularly dementia support, brain change support should be done by family and stuff. And it's like, well, who thinks that's a good idea? I mean, we're talking about people who were together for maybe if it was a child for 16 to 18 years of life, and then you went apart for a huge number of years and now you're coming back together. It's like, I'm not sure I'm prepared to parent you or care for you in the way that you prefer because I've been out of your life for a while. Or if I'm a spouse, I mean, our relationship and our arrangement as spouses is very different than it will be as a care provider and a care receiver. And if I'm not trained to become partners with you in care, it can be overwhelming for people. And I think we are so unaware of how much it takes to do this work that until you're in it, people think it's not that much. I mean, it's just quote unquote memory problems. And it's like tip of the iceberg. It's going to change everything.
Sure. Interesting. Yeah. So how can care partners balance empathy with self-preservation?
Yeah. I think for each person, it's going to be a unique balance, but I think to recognize there is a balance that's needed. From the very outset, being just in a partnership of one and one, there is no way at some point you're not going to be able to carry that human being's needs 24/7. So keeping that in mind, it's not fair to them to only get used to you. We've got to figure out early on, how do they get to a place of acknowledgement, recognition, willingness to have someone else in their life beside you. If they can't get that way, then a transition becomes incredibly hard for everyone, including sometimes then emergency rooms or psychiatric evaluations or absolute refusals or things you see on the news, which you don't want to see, where people wait too long and like some famous movie star end up dying in their home with their spouse and not even for 3 days recognizing that the person was no longer alive and not being able to get help. I mean, that's crazy that we're still doing that at this point in time, but the lack of awareness that, wow, 3 days before somebody realized it.
You know, I admit, when that happened, I think it was last year, within the last year and a half, maybe, but it was jarring to think that someone who had, and if you don't mind sharing who it was, you're talking about Gene Hackman, right? And his wife, and how somebody with that level of stature, and I'm sure he wasn't a perfect
resources,
person,
but
resources, you would like to think that they would be somewhat protected from it. But
it's that hiding thing, that discomfort with recognizing and not building a strong support outward of like, hey, this is really hard. I could use some support. Hey, Gene, would you rather hang out with so-and-so or so-and-so today? Because I need to go. I have treatments I have to go do. I mean, the dog's not well. The whole thing that happens all too often without the big celebrity is this happens to families day after day after day. And it's time for it to stop, frankly.
Sure, sure. So what are some of the ways that strong organizations are already supporting frontline care partners? And what can others learn from those examples?
Yeah, I think some of the most wonderful programs I've seen most recently is it's a group originally came out of Montgomery, Alabama, called Respite. It's a Respite for All program, and they help groups across the country, faith-based groups or nonprofits, get going and offer programming that gives you 4 hours a day at least to get a break from one another and find your joy, find your purpose, find your pleasure. And it serves other people as well as volunteer opportunities. So as I'm transitioning in my life from one area of my life to another, I get comfortable with it. I get familiar with it before I might be living with it inside or out. I think other groups that are working on the idea of friendship and competency, building bridges, working on entertainment opportunities that, like in Japan, there's a kitchen where you know you're going to have mistakes, but you come anyway because it's so cool to watch people have value and purpose and serve. And I think living with different generations, intergenerational projects are super cool, because they help us brain development, brain deterioration. You know, there's a balance here. So how do we learn to be with one another?
Interesting. So what advice do you give care partners who feel like they're failing?
It's time to stop and pause and tell me two things. Okay, so overall, you're telling me that your day is like down. Tell me two things that didn't go as badly as they could have today. What's one thing you wish were a little different? All right, let's focus on this. So tell me those two things again and say, I am pretty good at. Who do you have in your life that can help you with affirmation? And do you need more time for you so you can find what you're good at? And are you beating yourself up because you can't have what you used to have? And neither can your other person.
Interesting. That's good advice. And you know, I think it's important for people to be able to pause and think logically and critically, because sometimes it becomes such an emotional, spiral, doesn't it?
It's exhausting. I mean, people without training, it can be truly exhausting because you can't figure out how to do the engagement thing that you're trying to do. All you're doing is putting out fires for yourself and your person, and it's wearing you down, and you feel like I'll go till I drop. And it's like, then what?
Great point. So as cognitive needs change, senior living communities have to evolve. How should senior living communities adapt to better support cognitive change? And what are some of the, the best models out there that you've seen?
I would say one of the things that we're very shy about is recognizing, do we have baselines on everybody? Are we monitoring to see if there is a beginning of shift in ability, of language ability, of orientation ability, of visual capacity, of the ability to use your judgment, your sequencing? Are we noticing things? Does the person, are they aware of that? Because as we have a community, people like where they're at doing what they're doing until it's not working. And if we wait too long, then trying to do a transition is incredibly difficult for everybody involved. So if we have some transitions already built into the routines where people come together for this, they come apart for this, they go over here for this, and I start to notice, she's not going to that anymore. That's interesting. Let's have a conversation about that before it becomes, I told you I'm not doing that anymore. And it's like, whoa, wow, what's happening? Well, now we've got a bigger issue by the time we're picking up on it too often.
So truly being in tune is what I'm hearing you say with the individual.
Actively involved.
Involved. I like that. Yeah. I'm curious, as I've been in a number of different communities around the country, and there are different design things. I saw in one community a table that was toward the exit door where it would distract the resident and then perhaps, turn them around, or doors that were designed to match the door that they lived in, the home that they lived in. The communities that are built kind of in the round so that they could always have almost a runway and I don't mean to say they, but the resident, the sun setting with, where you can really control the windows and
lights.
Yeah. All of that being said, what are some of the features that you think are the most innovative, smart, just aspects, whether they're high tech or not, that
staff.
Right. Training staff.
Sure. I mean, if I were to be perfectly honest, all those things are great. But if you don't have trained staff who know how to use them and why to use them and when to use them, if you don't have a staff member who knows that what's on the table is not going to appeal to Harry, but, hey, Harry, look at this chair for me. It's not rolling like it should. Here, turn it upside down with me. Help me figure it out. If they don't know Harry used to be the handyman that would fix anybody's anything, even though what he is a lawyer with a high exec background, what Harry always loved to do is help people with little problems that he could solve. The lawyer thing, that's what earned the money. But what he really loved doing is being helpful to people. If I have a staff member that figures that out and can use that, what a difference it makes for everybody's life. Because Harry will try to argue his way out of the unit. And he wants to talk to the judge, and he's going to call him now, and he wants to see him in his chambers. And if I don't have staff that recognize, you're going to call the judge. You know what? Let me get the number for you. Oh, hey, Harry, could you do me a big favor?
That's great. So I hear you loud and clear. Staff training and, from the sensitivity to, trying to, I know instincts are not something you can teach, but trying to teach those things that would be normally instinctual are noticing. But what are some environmental factors that most influence behavior and well-being?
Yeah. If I'm telling you, listen, I need to go home, what we need to appreciate is something about the current environment is not speaking to a person's place of safety, of comfort, of connection, of function. So I need to listen to that and figure out what's not working for them. If people are comfortable in a setting, then there is enough visual activity, not too much. There's enough auditory activity. There's enough social. There's enough sensory stimulation, but there's not too much. And I have enough spaces that make me comfortable. So depending on who we're serving in that community, we should be modifying things to match the human being. So if I used to run marathons, and you put me in a small space, I'll be lapping and lapping and lapping and lapping. And if you can't figure out how to give me a finish line, I'll exhaust myself, because that nice circular pathway that allows me to walk, I will walk till I drop, unless somebody knows how to intervene and show me something else that I have finally completed my race here.
Sure. No, that's really interesting. You know, that's an important perspective. Now, I'm curious also, I've been, you know, over the years, trying to learn as much as I can about the Hugve model in the Netherlands. And I know there are various communities here in the States. There's one up in Langley, British Columbia, but that are trying to apply those principles here. What's your opinion of that? And is that a kind of a noble pursuit, or what are your thoughts there?
One of the challenges is they started with facilities and they built the community because they had the land and they encompassed and they created a town, essentially. And so people live in one of four types of cottages or locations once they, you know, gave up the huge complex model, because they were able to and built that out. I love a lot of what they do. I think in the States, we're a lot more diverse than they are in that environment. They fit into four nice, tidy groups. I think the Americans and Canadians, we have a lot more variety of where we came from, who we are, what cultural background we have. I think it's a bit harder sometimes, and in some words, maybe not, to come up with how we want to live together and who we would fit in well with and where we want to go when we're not there. So creating artificial towns might be a little complex, but we're working particularly trying to, how can we make this real? How can we train shopkeepers and restaurant owners and groceries so that when somebody comes in and says, well, I already bought that, you don't call the police, you go, absolutely. I apologize. I surely did not know that. I'm going to say I'm sorry right now. And then we know we're going to call her husband because I know where he is. I know what the story is. It's a small enough location. And we don't need to criminalize what is simply a cognitive impairment.
Sure. No, that's great. I mean, as you were talking about, and just thinking about the town and the artificial town reminded me of growing up in a small town in North Dakota, and there was a resident who was living in the local nursing home, and it was the county mm-hmm. home, and you know, it was a town of maybe, you know, 2,000 people or thereabouts, and everybody, I won't say names, but everybody knew that because it wasn't, they didn't have a memory support area, secured area. Everybody knew that if you saw her wandering town, you picked her up and brought her back. And it was just interesting yep. how, and this is small town North Dakota, which gets cold, but yes, community
yeah,
just
for
kind
sure.
of thought, okay, this person, we will all care for her. I mean, you know, the yeah. old, it takes a village, I guess. But
yeah. And I think the reality is it's going to take a village. And I don't know that we can build additional villages. Maybe we need to figure out how to make our villages a little more inclusive, a little more, because I think the numbers are going to break us emotionally, physically, socially, if we don't start acknowledging the presence of brain change in a variety of ways and keep thinking we can house it somewhere else. We can set it apart and medicalize it. And it's like, I don't know that we, yeah, I want all the researchers to keep working. That's cool. But in the meantime, maybe we could figure out how to do this thing we call supportive care. More globally, so that we're not having to do such the high price of and cost of care, which most folks aren't going to be able to afford, frankly.
Sure, sure. Now I'm curious, you know, I've been reading the stats and you're obviously much more intimately familiar with them, but with the increasing rates of people having brain change, mm-hmm. is that because we're tracking it better? Is it because we're living longer? Is it something else that you would see, or is that a misperception that it's really becoming mm-hmm. more prevalent?
I think some of our health behaviors, some of our life behaviors are starting to catch up with us. So we've got vascular dementia, which is often closely associated with lifestyle issues. We have Alzheimer's, which also lifestyle matters and exposure in the environment and toxins and viral load, et cetera. Sure. We also know that Lewy body is often a spontaneous phenomena. So I think we're living longer. Our fastest area of growth is old, which is our highest risk group for brain change. And now we have LATE, which is the TDP-43 anomaly, which is a newer dementia. We just sort of like, it's always been here. We just never knew to look for it. What we're discovering is, brain change. We've missed a lot of the early signs of it, and we've waited until it's intruded into relationships before we've picked up on it. If we got better at early identification, would it be possible to make shifts and changes? And I think there is a push to try to recognize earlier when we might be seeing initial early symptoms, which means we've already had the condition building up for a bit, so that we can intervene in more effective ways and retain that sense of independence and modified independence for much longer, because we're not ignoring it until it's insurmountable.
Interesting. Thank you for that perspective. So what role does leadership play in transforming dementia care culture within the senior living community environment?
Well, I think it's huge. Recognizing that leaders have a role to play both in how we prepare people for support and care, how we address this idea of we have brain change among us. So let's get super curious about our brain changes. And I am curious about my own. And so what we're going to do is promote brain fitness, body fitness, wellness, but you don't have to participate, but it's going to be offered in a different way. Even if you do have brain changes, we're not going to quit that idea of living well, supporting well, having purpose. And I think leaders will have to really acknowledge, wow, this is a major player in my building, in my organization. We built the small units thinking that's where we'll house everybody with brain change. The fact of the matter is there are people living with brain change throughout the building. And, you know, we could probably put the people not living with brain change in the small unit and everybody else could stay in the big building and we'd have more accurate representation. But people don't seem like they want to draw a line in the sand. This is dementia. This isn't. And it's like,
You're right. It is a scale or a sliding scale, continuum, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. And how we identify that and how we feel about that really matters. And it matters for leaders, I think, the variability of having employees who may have some brain change.
That's a really good point. Yeah, you're right.
Because they're living in incredibly stressful lives. They've got care at home. They've got care here. They often are a provider of their own family members. Their transportation is not great. I mean, the whole, it's like, yikes.
Sure. I'm curious, are you familiar with Stronger Memory from Goodwin Living? And I mean, we had Rob Liebrich on an earlier podcast talking about that and how they had developed it. But I think that's a really interesting way for people, at the very early stage to try to help impact brain health. Have you come across that much in your
work? Yeah, I think we're looking at a variety of people sort of saying, wait a minute, let's decide something different. Let's acknowledge, whoa, I see something going on here. Let's start building a change game here because we don't want it to go the same old way that it's gone. I mean, we're interested in trying something different at least.
Sure. Interesting. So, but before we wrap up, Tipa, tell us about your journey. How did you first get into this and develop the depth of expertise that you have?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, my grandfather developed dementia and moved in with us when I was a younger kid, young woman. My grandma on the other side developed a dementia a little bit later. I was in my 20s, early 30s. But at the time, I was interested in developmental disabilities. I was really fascinated by kids who had changes from when they were very young or at birth. And so I was doing a lot of volunteer work as a teenager in developmental disabilities. And then in my undergraduate opportunity, I worked in a day center where they had people with dementia and kids with developmental disabilities. And I got to see sort of like, huh, interesting. So when I finished OT school, it was a geriatrics opportunity. And there it went. So I just kept going in that direction with my, with many of the folks that I found fascinating in head injury, brain injury resulting from stroke, looking at chronic diseases that result in brain changes, working with younger people with head injuries again. So a whole variety of a brain change over my career.
So tell us about your business now, and if I can call it a business or your service or your practice. Talk a little about that, if you would, please.
Yeah. So we have two groups. One is Positive Approach to Care, which is, quote unquote, a for-profit company where we do training for professionals, organizations. We work with people living with dementia to make sure there's always a component of their perspective entered into the work that we do. We work with families. We work with teams. And then what we have is the Snow Approach Foundation, which is a nonprofit here in the Hillsborough, North Carolina area, where we have a demonstration of what it looks like in community, but we also bring people in as part of their training to experience what it feels like and is to be present in a community where we're working on that idea of creating a competent community for support and care. So we have an international presence, but we have people across the U.S., across Canada. We have folks in about, I think, 25 countries now. And we're working hard as a community to build awareness, knowledge, and skill for everyone.
So thinking about the 25 different countries or thereabouts that you work with, how... And I'm not trying to get political or anything else, but does the approach in the United States stack up to some of our peers in, you know, around the world?
It's so interesting how so many countries go, oh, well, we're not doing a really good job, but so-and-so is. And so you go to so-and-so and they go, oh, we're not doing a really good job, but so-and-so is. And what I have found, there's these little pods of excellence of different things in all these different countries. And there's a global sense of, and yet... we don't know what we're doing and we don't know how to do it on a scale that we need to, whether it's Australia, Malaysia, whether it's China, whether it's Japan, whether it's England or Wales or Portugal. I mean, we find that there are these little pockets of folks who are really working hard to expand. And yet then there's like the global system of, oh, it's old business as usual.
Sure. Interesting.
And we're just at a change point, I think.
Now, do you see here in a, this is not a question that we had discussed beforehand, so I don't, you might not have the stats, but is are the cases in the States at a higher degree or higher per capita than other parts of the country? You know, because I know we talked about some of the environmental kinds of things here.
Yeah. So one of the tricky parts, our diet and exercise pattern is not great. I mean, let's just be honest, we're in our social engagement model is not terrific. So we're certainly higher risk than many other countries where they've really worked hard and they sustain, they've got some blue zones going on. What I would say is our willingness to acknowledge what we're looking at as the brain change that is probably coming with a dementia is low. And so we want to keep things under the radar until we can't hide it anymore, which is an interesting sort of phenomena to try to work with because people, she has just memory problems. I don't think it's dementia until it's like, so she doesn't remember that she just ate lunch. Well, yeah, but I mean, sometimes she does. It's like, that's not typical aging. What you're describing is not typical aging. I know whether I ate lunch. I can think back and put it all together. It takes me a second maybe to go, what did I eat today? Oh, that's right. I had this. But I can go back through my memory files, go to the kitchen refrigerator and open it up and go, ah, now I remember. That's right. I made a sandwich. Oh, I didn't have bread, so I had to end up making. And I'm accurate. I mean, when I'm not able to do that, one has to wonder. Now, if I've never been good at it, I hope we know that.
Sure.
So, not accusing me of a change when I've just never been good. But I think in the U.S. particularly, we're avoiding the question until we can't avoid it anymore. And I've actually had physicians say, well, why would I bother? I don't have the resources to give them anyway. I mean, until it's worse. And it's like, well, that's not good, because that means they're not getting any support to change the possible trajectory that they're going to experience if we don't start thinking there are things we can do now that would matter.
Mm-hmm. Important
social engagement, if nothing else.
Yeah. And, you know, it is interesting because every now and again you'll hear, by remaining socially engaged or by having close, at least two or three or five close friends, all of these things, increase or decrease your chance of brain
significantly.
Change.
Significantly. Yeah. 5 minutes of exercise could make a difference.
Yep.
You know, getting outside regularly can make a difference for you.
Sure. So before we get to the last question, when you and I were visiting earlier, I'd asked you how, because I love the name Tipa Snow and Tipa, and you had a great story there. Share how, what's the derivation of Tipa?
When I was a teenager, kids were coming out of institutional care back home to their families, and their families were being asked to pick up the pieces from where we had said, we can do better care than you can, especially with autism and cerebral palsy. Like, you don't know what you're doing. Send them to us. We'll do a great job. And then they found out, oh, this is harder than I thought. It's not working well. Send them back to the families. So there was a young man that was a special ed teacher that brought a bunch of us teenagers together and said, we need a respite program for families. And so I had a little respite group. I think I had six kids that were my kids. And one of the kids was named Michael. And Michael had a speech problem and a hearing problem a little bit. And he also had autism. And so my name was Tina, T-E-E-N-A, which was my mom thought a clever way to spell Tina. It is not. Tina is T-I-N-A. Just spell it that way.
Sure.
But Michael couldn't say Tina. He said, Tipa, tell me toy. Hey, Tipa, Tipa. And so all my friends and family started calling me Tipa. And so gradually, by the time I was a young woman, it's like nobody called me Tina. Everyone called me Tipa. So I legally changed it. So it's a given name from Michael.
That's wonderful. And what a great way to, honor the legacy and the relationship there. I love that story. So last question, what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
Ooh. Don't worry about the road you're on. You'll end up where you're supposed to be when you find the right exits.
Wise words.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, Tipa, thank you so much for the time, for your sharing your insights, your thoughts, your wisdom. Really appreciate it, and I know all of our listeners will as well. So thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. I'm Derek Dunham, and thank you also to Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. And we'll see you next time on Varsity's Roundtable Talk.